these ideas, you know, stormed to power in incredible speed. I mean, it's hard to think of historical analogs of just how quickly a new set of ideas came to be so influential in a major democracy. There was such a fear of criticizing these ideas because somebody would accuse you of being on the side of Trump or something like that, that sort of in polite society in the United States, nobody criticized these ideas. Privately, yes, but publicly, no.
China might be the world's great factory, but America remains the world's great cultural hegemon. And perhaps its greatest export of the last decade has been wokeism or wokeness. Concepts like cultural appropriation, systemic racism, critical race theory, intersectionality, and so many others were once on the fringes of American academia, but have now exploded globally and especially in Europe. So, we wanted to take time to define wokeism, explore the concepts from its roots in critical theory to its manifestations in contemporary discourse. In order to do so, we dissect the complex tapestry of wokeism and explore how it has sparked explosive conversations on both sides of the Atlantic. We are joined today by Jascha Munk, a German intellectual, founder of Persuasion magazine, the author of numerous books, including on today's topic, The Identity Trap, a story of ideas and power in our time. On the other side of the line, we are joined by Pierre Valentin. He is, as some of you might have guessed, my very smart brother, but most importantly, the author of Comprendre la Révolution Woke, translated in good English as Understanding the Woke Revolution. As always, please rate and review Uncommon Decency on whatever platform you use, and send us your comments or questions either on Twitter at UndecencyPod or by email at undecencypod@gmail.com. And please consider supporting the show through Patreon. The link is down below in the description. You can get access to the full episode where we talk in further detail about France and le wokisme and wonder whether we have reached in 2024 peak woke. Now, on to the episode.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Uncommon Decency, where today we are going to be talking about wokeism. And for this episode, we have two very special guests. We have Jascha Munk, the distinguished scholar on democracy from Johns Hopkins University. And we also, in the grand tradition of podcasts inviting siblings on to the show to talk about things that they've written, we have Pierre Valentin, brother of François. So we are following the tradition of The Rest is History, which had James Holland on to talk about the Second World War with Tom Holland, a much better example of bringing siblings onto your show than the CNN example, which I will not mention any further. Yeah. Jascha, Pierre, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I should have brought my brother.
So I hate to do that, but I feel we still need to do this at this point in 2024. Let's start with a definition of what, Pierre, you call wokeism, what, Jascha, you chose another word for, and we'll probably go into that. Maybe, Pierre, let's start with you. How do we define this movement and why this name to identify it?
Sure. So for me, woke ideology is an ideology which perceives Western societies as being fundamentally structured by power structures, relationships of domination, of oppression, and which inferiorizes the other with a capital O, which is the figure of the minority in different shapes and sizes. The reason why I think the term woke is interesting is, first of all, it's initially a term which comes from the leftist radicals themselves and not a right-wing creation or imposition. It has become less popular, but still in 2021, we had 12% of UK people who recognize themselves as being woke. So we'd have to go and tell them that they're wrong in doing so, and I'm not willing to do that. And also, I think the symbolism of being awakened is very strong. It's very strong within conspiracy movements. There are those who are asleep and those who are awake. And it really shows the kind of elitism and paternalism, which is intrinsic for me to this movement, which is, I will tell minorities who are asleep, like black minorities, for instance, that they've internalized racism. I'm here to wake them up from their slumber. And so I think this is why the term is important. It's also important because it helps situate, and this is one of my main focuses with the book, the woke phenomenon in a wider time frame than, let's say, the last 10 years. There was in the history of American Protestantism an event which, according to different historians, happened 3 or 4 times, which were great awakenings. And so I thought it was very both ironic and fascinating to see a young movement, which very certainly conceives of itself as entirely atheistic and original, use this term without realizing it was unwittingly inscribing itself in a long history of American Protestantism. Now, of course, now it's post-Protestantism, as the intellectual Joseph Bottom would say in his book An Anxious Age, but it's still a form of Protestantism. And so I think that's why, for me, the term is important, as is, although I sympathize with the willingness to try and find a neutral playing field. But I think when you're with bad faith actors, which is often the case with the true believers, say, in wokeism, you can never satisfy them. They'll keep on playing semantic word plays. And so I think it's ultimately doomed to fail in that regard.
Yasha, you found another word. Does it matter how we name this movement?
It matters somewhat. I don't think it's the most important question. I find sort of as two terms that people tend to use. One is identity politics, which I think is a little bit too broad. I think there's forms of politics that could be described as identity politics that are perfectly legitimate. You can say that Frederick Douglass or Martin Luther King engaged in identity politics, if that's the term you want to choose. And I think they certainly were very admirable historical figures who helped to bring us closer to living up to our common values. And then there's the term woke, which I don't avoid. I don't think it's a problem, but it just sort of has a slightly polemical feel. When you think of an ideology like socialism, there's some people who are socialists, who adopt the term, and there's some people who hate socialism who can also use that term. So it's helpful to have a more neutral term to refer to an ideology, one that its defenders and its detractors can both use. I suggest the term identity synthesis. That I think was very helpful for me in writing the book and just criticizing and critiquing and explaining this ideology in a measured way. I don't have any great hopes that term is going to take over the world. I don't think it needs to. But I want to speak a little bit to the earlier question about how to define the substance of these ideas as well, if I may. I think there's sort of two ways of approaching ideas. One is historically, right? Where do these ideas come from? How did they develop? And I do some of that in my book in The Identity Trap, really thinking through what the intellectual history of the identity synthesis is and how that helps to explain some of its main themes, from a general skepticism about the possibility of universal truths to a sort of politicized use of discourse analysis to really do politics by changing how we speak about the world, to an embrace of strategic essentialism, the idea that actually it's emancipatory if we teach students in school to define themselves by their race, to concepts like the sort of deep skepticism, pessimism about the ability to make progress without turning our society into a place where we always treat each other according to the kind of group to which we belong, to the idea of intersectionality. But there's a second way to approach an idea as well, and that's not through sort of themes that emerge from the way in which an ideology developed, but rather to offer what philosophers call a rational reconstruction, to say, all right, there's this sort of field of ideas that are interrelated and connected, and we can kind of see that they're logically common, but nobody's really quite put order into it. How can we boil this down to some of the key tenets that most of the adherents of this ideology share? And so I offer that as well in my book. And I think there's sort of three key tenets that most quote-unquote woke people believe in one way or another. And that's number one, that the key prism for understanding the world, the key way to understand social reality is through identity categories like race and gender and sexual orientation. But just as Marxists thought that to understand the world, you have to look at class, the woke think that to understand the world, you have to look at these basic identity categories. The second is the claim that universal values and neutral rules, the basic principles of liberal democracy, haven't just failed to create utopia, haven't just failed to create a greatly just or equal society. We haven't made any progress in that direction. And that's because those values were actually meant to pull the wool over your eyes, right? They're actually meant to hide the real operation of social reality so that you're not fully conscious of it. And then therefore the third claim, the upshot of this, which follows relatively logically if you buy the first two premises, is we have to rip up all universal rules and neutral values. Sorry, universal values and neutral rules. We have to rip up the basic functioning of our society and make how we treat each other in this conversation and how the state treats all of us in all kinds of different social and political and cultural contexts explicitly depend on the kind of identity group to which we belong. And I think a lot of the core ideas and themes of this new movement are really encapsulated in these three tenets.
Pierre, I want to go back to you with a sort of following up on what Yasha was saying about the impact and the way this ideology shapes the way people are seeing society. The argument that would often be put forward is that these are well-intentioned people trying to give a voice to marginalized groups and provide a framework for understanding disparities in society. For those who aren't attuned to these developments and these debates, on a sort of ground level, why should people care about the influence of wokeism and woke ideology in society?
So yeah, two things there, I guess. So first is the question on the good intentions, and then there's on why should, you know, the layman care about wokeism. I think I'll start with the second one first, which is it has no good reason in its way of functioning to stop politely at any door, at any wall, at any, you know, stop. Because, for instance, we saw, you know, Ben and Jerry's, which are meant to sell ice cream. They didn't mind, you know, lecturing their public on systemic racism. We saw banks start debanking on political lines. So there's not this kind of, you know, polite functioning of, oh, we'll just keep this within the arena of political ideas, and then we'll stop at your door. We saw, like, people, for instance, especially since COVID, are streaming a huge quantity of films and of series at home. These have been changed as well by woke ideology. So there's no such thing as I'll bunker down and I'll be free from it. It's a wave which is hitting society in its entirety. So it's worth understanding it. On the question of good intentions, I think this is potentially an area of disagreement we might have. I don't believe it's filled with good intentions. Now, of course, there's a difference between, you know, those who really actively believe it and the more passive followers. But for those who really, truly believe in wokeness, I think the Nietzschean analysis of ressentiment and resentment is actually an interesting framework, because it's one which is used by Douglas Murray in The War on the West, where he says that the people of resentment only ever complement A in the view of denigrating and criticizing B. And I think this is very true with how wokeism functions with minorities. People say they're full of good intentions. They just want equality to defend minorities, except they don't defend minorities as such. They only ever defend minorities when they can denigrate, when they can be used to denigrate the majority. I'll give you a few examples. We saw, for instance, critical race theory being put to the test in the past few months, and even before that, where it had to choose. So just to explain briefly critical race theory, it's the idea that we have an omnipotent and omnipresent system of whiteness which controls the West and America in particular, and which has built itself in the image of those who've created it, so in the image of white people and whiteness. And within the US, we have at least two inconvenient facts in regards to that theory, which is white Jewish people and Asian Americans have been vastly successful, and more so than the average American, And so then we have critical race theorists, which have a choice. Do I defend my theory or do I defend my minorities? And what ended up in happening is these people said, actually, Jewish people are white adjacent. Asian Americans are white adjacent, which means symbolically they're no longer really minorities. So we saw that the defense of these minorities was only a stopgap to sort of make history move forward in a kind of a Hegelian fashion. And once history doesn't need them, we can just chuck them away. And I think the anti-Semitism that we saw since the 7th of October, but which was brewing underneath the surface before that, is a key example of the fact that there was never in this kind of way in thinking a defense of the Jews as such. It was a defense of the Jew capable of calling the West anti-Semitic, just as there's a defense of the black figure as a stopgap to criticize the West for being racist. The utility of the person who is handicapped is to call the West a handiphobe. The utility of the person who is transgender is to be able to call the West transphobic. So it's a means to an end. It's instrumental. And I think that shows that it's a question of resentment and of deconstruction and not a question of, you know, lovingly want to bring equality for all. And why is this important? Because not only is it wrong, but also it has consequences, because people say, people tend to hold back their hits, in a sense. If you tell them it's good intentions, they say, oh, it's just young people filled with good intentions. Then they won't criticize it as much as it should be. And I think that's why the question of good intentions, although ultimately intentions are deep down unknowable, but you know, on average in the broader scale of things, is so important.
Yasha, maybe, do you have a kind of a road to Damascus moment where you saw, oh, actually, this is creeping from theory into practice with potentially devastating impact? Is there kind of one moment you can point to thinking, well, actually, I need to take this seriously?
A little bit, yes. I mean, I sort of started to encounter these ideas, you know, in academic seminars and certain kind of academic journals and so on. And I sort of thought, well, you know, these ideas are going to go the way that most academic theories go, which is that, you know, they create a little bit of noise in some small corner of the world, but surely they're not going to be some kind of mass movement. I remember stumbling across a website called everydayfeminism.com in around 2015, and suddenly seeing these ideas sort of transmogrified into sort of BuzzFeed listicle style, you know, very shareable content. So, you know, it's like, you know, five things you can tell your yoga teacher who thinks that cultural appropriation is fun, you know, and like stuff like that. And I was like, wow, I mean, they sort of have managed to transform this idea, the set of sort of quite abstruse academic ideas, into this sort of approachable, simplistic view of a world that, you know, you learn a few basic categories and a few basic ways of thinking about it, and you can waltz into any conversation and say, you guys are all terrible because you don't understand what's really going on. And here I am, the moral superior person who gets to sit in judgment of you and who gets to be part of this great movement for historical justice. And I thought that actually could be appealing at a broader scale. And so that's sort of when I started taking it seriously as something that you know, might escape campus a few years before people started to say, you know, we all live on campus now, which, you know, surely has become true. The, you know, it's interesting to think about the intentions. And obviously, human beings are varied, and human beings who share a particular ideology are varied. And so there's going to be a big range in what ultimately drives people. You know, I certainly think that many of the students I have at the moment, you know, well-intentioned, thoughtful people who are actually willing to engage in debate. At this point, you know, the identity synthesis is all they've learned, right? Like, that's what's been taught to them when they're 6 years old and 10 years old and 15 years old. And so certainly I think many of them don't have the kind of ressentiment that you've been speaking about. They simply, like perhaps most of us at a certain age, you know, broadly have a worldview of the social milieu around us and of our teachers. And I see as part of my role in the classroom as giving them the tools to think for themselves. And some of them will continue to believe in these ideas. And many of them, I think, will start to be quite skeptical of them. At the same time, there's some good research that political extremists are often over proportionally have a dark personality triad. So if you have narcissism and Machiavellianism, and other sort of bad psychological traits, being part of an extremist movement gives you an excuse to dominate others, to exercise power, to justify violence, and so on. And I think that there is you know, some element of that, but some of the most sort of extreme ideologues on the woke side, as among other extremist movements, you know, do clearly have sort of elevated values on the dark personality triad. And so they certainly aren't well-intentioned, right? For them, they might think they're well-intentioned, but they're really driven by this, not ressentiment, but will to power, perhaps. You know, but fundamentally, I think, you know, how do you understand this ideology? I think the point you're making is very interesting, it's thought-provoking, but I think it's a little bit simpler than that. You know, what this ideology says is that you have to sort of understand the whole world in terms of power relations. And if some group is powerful, then it must be bad and it's not really in need of defense. And if some group is marginalized and weak, then it is virtuous and you have to make excuses for it, no matter what its behavior, no matter what kind of action it engages in. And that, of course, is a very simplistic and Manichaean world of, view of a world that I reject for many reasons. But I think that gets more straightforwardly at the core of a moral instinct here. And then, you know, we can have different opinions about whether that's, you know, is that a good set of intentions or a bad set of intentions or something in between. I don't really know. But I think that's sort of what you know, that is the basic ideological category, right? Are you part of a powerful group? And if so, then you must have done terrible things and we should be very skeptical of you. Or you're part of a marginalized group. If so, you're a victim and morally superior and you deserve our unreserved solidarity. That helps to sort of predict the particular positions that people take 90% of the time. And it helps to explain why at some point Jews were part of the kind of victim category and the category to which you know, people who adhere to his ideology had some amount of sympathy. Now they're perceived or portrayed as being sort of powerful and privileged, and so therefore suddenly they're part of the baddies.
I'd like to take a dive into the intellectual history of this form of politics and this movement. Pierre, can you walk us through the intellectual and philosophical family tree for woke ideology, where it starts and who the leading thinkers have been and who they are now today?
Sure. So for me, there's a guiding paradox which leads us down two different roads. That guiding paradox is that if you are transgender, so if you are sitting in between, in a sense, male and female, just as intersex, although transgender is more fluid and hence has a higher deconstructive potential in a sense, then you will be glorified as a hybrid figure. Whereas those who have tried to go down the transracial route have been viciously vilified and criticized. And so for me, that tells me that we are faced with two different sort of ideological origins and two different roads. So let's do them in order. For the fluid, the gender fluid side of things, I think, unsurprisingly, Judith Butler has a very important role here, where there's this fascination for everything which is fluid, moving, etc. And in that sense, I think the sort of relationship they have to fluidity is very strong within wokeism. However, if we look at, for example, people who are theoretically mixed race, they are put forth not as this interesting hybrid figure which could deconstruct the categories black and white. They're sort of brought back into the binary saying, no, you're not in between, you're black. And we can celebrate you as black, not as an in-between. Whereas for gender, it's as an in-between. And for me, this is where I think on the race dimension of things, the origins are Marxist. Now, of course, there's always a difficulty with establishing any kind of heritage, intellectual heritage with Marxism, is the fact it moves dialectically. So you can never say, oh, look, it's quite organically, you know, moving down from one thinker to the next, because they always tend, as Marx did with Hegel, in a sense, flip the guy before upside down, which means the guy before can always say, well, it's not my responsibility. They've done the opposite of what I proposed. But that's their conception of the dialectic. And so I think Herbert Marcuse, for the race dimension, is particularly influential. I think this is a point we agree upon. And for instance, it's very important for the non-white bloc to consider itself as non-white, just as it's very important for the proletariat to consider itself as proletariat. And in a sense, if you have a kind of Judith Butler who arrives in that kind of discussion and says, oh, let's disrupt all norms, let's say categories are meaningless, let's say white and black are social constructs imposed upon us by the system, well, she'd get booed out of the classroom. That's, you know, we don't do that here, as the meme goes. They wouldn't want that. And so you cannot dilute, you cannot, you know, hybrid. There's no fascination for the hybrid in this context, the blocks. You have to make a revolution with these blocks, who are here, the lower block is here to highlight the contradictions, as they say, of the existing society. And it is here to accomplish this revolution. And so in this sense, I think it is Marxist. Of course, letting go of class is no mean feat. It implies quite a substantial change. But, you know, theoretically, they'll say it's, you know, more, it's not vulgar Marxism, as the Marxists always like to say about the preceding Marxists. They say, no, it's no longer vulgar Marxism, it's subtle Marxism. And we have now an intersection of many different possibilities, amongst which we still tolerate class. Now, I agree with Yasha in his book that it's more of an afterthought than something deeply inscribed. And it would also be quite, you know, a delicate for them, because if you want to speak in class analysis, the people who speak of this are quite clearly, you know, overeducated and quite comfortable in most cases, especially in the US. It's less true in France. But so I think this is why we can explain this paradox of the transgender, transracial, as one comes from postmodern thinking and Judith Butler, and the other from critical race theory and the Frankfurt School, and in particular Herbert Marcuse.
And Yasha, maybe we could talk about French theory, we could go back to La Sorbonne in the 1960s, but maybe let's take a few steps further down the road. How does this kind of intellectual movement translate into kind of mass popular culture? Because you're not only talking about Judith Butler, you're also talking maybe about people like Ibram Kendi and so on. How do you get this kind of very abstract, very complicated, at times very contradictory intellectual movements into this kind of mass packaged, easy to consume intellectual product?
Yeah, this, so, you know, my book is four parts. The first was just reading a straightforward intellectual history of where these ideas come from, which I do locate a little bit more in postmodernism and postcolonialism than in the Frankfurt School or in Marxism. And that's a fun debate to have perhaps another time. And then the second part of the book, I really tried to say, all right, so like by 2010, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw, one of the founders of critical race theory, the person who came up with that term, writes an article celebrating the 20th anniversary of the movement. And she says, look, you know, we now have all kinds of fancy professorships and, you know, we've become pretty influential in law schools and so on. But of course, we have absolutely no hope of having real influence in the world. And by the way, this guy Barack Obama was just elected. You know, his philosophy is diametrically opposed to critical race theory. And so therefore, the hopes for us to break through have gotten even smaller, which shows you something about, you know, just how much of an attack this new ideology is on the mainstream black political tradition in the United States, which I think is very interesting. But she turns out to be wrong, right? 10 years later, these ideas have become hugely influential, not just in the public sphere with best-selling authors like Ibram X. Kendi and Robin DiAngelo, who completely dominated bestseller lists in 2020, but in terms of the way in which institutions now work and function in the United States. And so the story of that is very interesting. I trace it in the second part of my book. I think it has something to do with what I'm calling a short march through the institutions. So not the long march that the 68ers embarked on. It took them a number of decades to get into positions of influence and power. And many of them had sort of shed a lot of their beliefs by the time they did. But a much quicker, much shorter march through institutions, particularly in places that recruit heavily from elite universities, give a lot of weight to the young employees, and have a self-conception of somehow doing good. So whether that's Google with its claim that it has quietly dropped at some point of do no evil, whether that's the nonprofit sector, whether that's progressive political organizations, they're particularly exposed to this. I mean, I think a very important mechanism was the internet and social media. I think there's a very interesting role that a now mostly forgotten platform called Tumblr played, in which people for the first time could tag themselves by anything, but in particular by identity groups. And people sort of found each other on this platform across these more and more segmented identity groups. And in a way, you can think of this as a technological revolution of how identity works, right? If you went to a school in analog times and you wanted to have some kind of identity, you had to have a few other people who shared that identity with you, and they probably had to have some physical presence in your life. So you could only draw on 80, 100 people to constitute this identity. And so that meant that you could only have about 5 or 6 identities, right? Now suddenly you could find 7 people somewhere in the world, somewhere in the country that shared some nascent identity with you and define yourself around that. So Tumblr became this great place of experimentation.
So Tumblr is like the printing press for Protestants in the 16th century, basically.
It is, I think, yes. And then you need, you know, when you have all these identity tribes, then you need some kind of overarching ideology to keep them together, to keep the peace between them as best as possible. And that becomes this kind of popularized, vulgarized version of the identity synthesis, a popularized version, vulgarized version of the ideas of Michel Foucault and Edward Said and Gayatri Spivak and Derek Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw and Judith Butler and so on. And then, you know, through various mechanisms in the mid and late 2010s, you know, media is really in a huge crisis. They desperately need clicks. They see that some of this kind of content is going viral. They hire those journalists, and very quickly, these ideas enter the political mainstream, at least in the United States.
I want to talk a little bit about your Pierre, you're French, Yasha, you're German. I want to talk about how this conversation has happened also in Europe. Because my understanding is that conversation has been very different from on one side of Atlantic compared to the other. Pierre, maybe could starting with you, how has this conversation around wokeism or le wokisme in France happened? I've got a theory, let me know if you agree with me, that essentially I think there's been a much stronger backlash against those set of ideas within French institutions, political class, for example, even on the left. Because I think those movements, those ideas came after a decade of jihadist attacks in France, which kind of forced French society, French elites to kind of think about their political model, about, you know, universal values. It was after the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, the rest of that. My hunch is that woke ideas arrived in France at a time where there's a lot of kind of soul searching about what it meant to be French and what the French model was. And the kind of the woke narrative, which was attacking quite frontally, you know, kind of a liberal universal model and also quite disruptive in trying to break society in different groups, was seen as dangerous given what we've been seeing on the front of jihadism. Is that something you can relate to?
Hi there. If you want to listen to the full episode where our guests go in further detail, especially on the French left and whether we have reached peak woke, you can join us in our Patreon section for as little as €5 a month. Otherwise, see you very soon.
Thanks a lot, Pierre. Thanks a lot, Yasha, for this conversation. There was a lot we could have covered on the kind of psychological reasons that lead people to join those movements. But thank you so much for taking the time. You've both got fascinating books, which will be both in the description below for people to buy if they want to hear their versions in French for Pierre and in English for Yasha. Thank you so much to both of you. Oh, sorry, Yasha, you're translating French. Of course, you did your tour. Great. Well, even more options. You can Yasha in English. You could read Yasha in English and in French to see which is best. But anyways, thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you so much. Thanks to both of you.
So, Yasha and Pierre are both out. It is myself and Francois here to discuss primarily Francois's thoughts because a technical glitch knocked me out of the podcast for the last half of the recording. But hey, these are things we have to deal with in life sometimes. So, Francois, I'll kick it off by asking what your... Well, actually, no, I'll start with a different question to what I was going to ask. What for you why do you think this podcast in particular was so important that we cover this topic? I mean, we touch on it loosely and occasionally, but it's never something we've really done like a full deep dive into. So why now and why this particular topic?
Yeah, it's a topic that's a bit difficult because it can get quite cringy quite quickly, I will say. So, I mean, I've been uncomfortable with the way the word woke has been kind of used to describe anything that is that people don't like. But that said, there is a kind of real ideological movement, which I think we both saw, you know, at its premises on universities back when we were students in the US, and that has kind of only gained power and influence even further in the academic world, but across business, across politics and so on. So, you know, there's always going to be an interest for us. We did one previous episode on wokeism. So I think one episode every 100 is a healthy ratio. But I think the reason we want to talk about it now is I think in the midst of the 7th of October, the reaction in some campuses, but not campuses, are kind of across society, especially in the US and also somewhat in the UK, was I think a sign that things had gone way too far, way too long unchecked. And as Pierre says in the Patreon section, I think it comes down a lot to the fact that on the center left, especially, a lot of people kind of were cowered into either mouthing those concepts or at least staying put about them. And now I think the reason in France there is still kind of a inter-left-wing fighting along those lines is because I think there was a conscience in France that we need to kind of stand for universal values as much as we can, because the moment we engage in a form of even well-intentioned tribalism, you get very dangerous consequences down the road. You get essentially either us versus them narrative, but left-wing imposed on society, and I think that's quite unhealthy. So that's why we wanted to do it. It's difficult to talk about this issue in 45 minutes because there's a lot going on. I kind of wish I had actually asked Yasha especially to kind of maybe point out at maybe some of the social advances which he could credit to kind of woke movement or the identity synthesis movement. Does he think actually America has done progress on its approach to race as a result? Could you credit gay wedding to the woke movement? You know, is there stuff like that which you could actually take a step back and say, with all its successes and dangers, there have been some gains? Or would he actually argue that it's the opposite? Actually, race in America has become much more toxic as a result of movements like that. And actually, the reason we had gay wedding is because of the kind of legwork that had been done by gay movements in the 1970s, 1980s, which were very different from what we have nowadays. But I think that would be an interesting conversation to explore. But we had to choose our topics in 45 minutes or so. So decided to go for what we had. And I think, especially in the Patreon section, the conversation about France, I think, was really interesting. There's been such a lot of soul searching, a lot of infighting in France around wokeism, but also I think a much more unified pushback from French elites against woke movement compared to what you see in the UK, but especially in the US.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting the differing political reactions to what we describe as wokeism. And I think sometimes, and admittedly, you know, my media consumption is more focused on the US side, given that I live here. Whenever the phrase woke is brought up, it's usually by one of the late night hosts on Fox News, and it ends up becoming a sort of parody of itself. But there are very real world applications of it that you can see and experience. And one anecdote that I will share quickly was being at dinner with some friends, and my waiter insisted, because I looked North African, he insisted on telling me about the fact that he had read Fanon, and then decided to tell me that I was oppressed because of this fact. And as much as I appreciate people's desire to read more, and will always welcome that, it is quite annoying to have someone tell you that you're oppressed at a dinner table. and you're just trying to enjoy a birthday meal. I think those are the sort of day-to-day interactions. And we sort of touched on it a little bit about how the good intentions aspect, your brother mentioned this, that the good intentions aspect of perhaps a small part of the community, ones who sort of want to raise awareness or contribute to a debate around power structures in society, gets swept up with the performative aspect. Yeah. And I think that's, for me, has always been, whenever I sort of think about, you know, this concept of wokeism, is it's all about the difference between the performative nature of the ideological subscription and then the actual belief. And I think, you know, we've talked about since October 7th, I was walking through a university campus the other day, and there were pro-Palestinian protests going on, as is there, right, as students and citizens in the US. But the question in the back of my mind, as I sort of look at the protesters, is how much of this is genuine passion fervor? How much, how long have you been concerned about the Middle East, concerned about Palestinian nationalism, and how much of this is performative? And I think that's an element where, you know, again, we could discuss for hours about the performative nature. But I want to ask you another sort of follow-up based on the conversation that I sort of missed between you, Yasha, and Pierre. The political reaction on the right, I don't know if this was discussed, but the political reaction on the right, we have European elections, Conservative Party increasingly is talking about this. Do you feel that this is a winning, an electoral winning argument?
Yeah.
For the right in Europe, as we see wokeism sort of become more of a conversation in the media and in politics?
That's a great question. I actually looked at this a few years ago ahead of the 2019 elections in the UK. And sorry, not 2019, post-2019. The British Conservatives had done something quite remarkable, which is, in a pretty desperate situation, Boris Johnson had managed to use Brexit as a wedge issue to kind of divide the left and get a lot of traditional Labour left-wing voters, people who had been in districts that had been voting red for the last 80 years. And after that effect dissipated, there was like a search for the kind of next wedge that the Conservatives could use to bruise the left. And there was a lot of people saying, oh, wokeism is going to be that wedge. And we can, you know, this was back when Keir Starmer was taking the knee for BLM and so on. So, you know, they had kind of a bit of a target. But actually what I thought was quite interesting is, compared to an issue like Brexit, first of all, it is still relatively niche. And I think one of the reasons we started with an introduction and a definition of wokeism is, I think for many people, it's still not very clear what it is and what it stands for. And again, not everyone is an expert on what socialism means, but I think people kind of have a general sense of what it stands for. Wokeism, I think, is a lot more nebulous of a point and is often used for like progressive stuff that people don't like as well. So I think it's important to define it. So first of all, there's issue of identification. Secondly, as well, it's not clear to people, you know, it's not like vote for Boris Johnson and I'll get Brexit done. If I vote for the conservatism, am I going to get rid of wokeism? No, not really. It's a talking point. They say we don't like wokeism. And so there's not this kind of connection between the vote and the consequences in a way that you had with other wedge issues. So I don't think it will be as big an issue. I will say, however, given this is the European elections, we've done a previous episode on wokeism, which focused on the European institutions and how European institutions, especially around the Commission, had been infiltrated, I will say, by kind of Islamist Muslim Brotherhood adjacent groups. It's always difficult with Muslim Brotherhood because they use kind of different fronts and so on, to essentially push their propaganda using kind of anti-racist language. And that's one thing I think where the European elections would actually matter is talking about those issues. Actually, the European Union gives a lot of funding to different organizations. Many of them, I think people would agree across Europe, have not much to do with European values and actually quite sometimes are defending values which, you know, you could find with Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, for example. So I don't think it'll be a big issue for the European elections. I think immigration is much more likely to be a big issue, given people know what we're talking about mostly, and there's a bit more of a kind of link between the votes and the consequences, as I was saying. So I don't think it will be a major electoral issue. Might here and there, maybe. But I think it is also maybe a shame, not that I want it to be, but I also think there should be a lot more scrutiny from the European Parliament on what the Commission does, on who, on what kind of money it's throwing around to different organisations, especially one of those organisations. I mean, I don't really care whether woke, but if they kind of defend values which are kind of very aggressively against kind of basic universal values that we should be sharing as liberal democracies, then clearly the Parliament should be doing its job to check and control what the Commission is doing.
And I think on that note, with a slight tease for towards the future of Europe and European politics with an election, we might have to call it. Francois, thank you so much for putting this episode together and for tolerating my technical issues all throughout today.
And thanks a lot, Julian, as well, for making it. Thanks a lot to Yasha. Thanks a lot to my brother, Pierre. Fun fact, Pierre was actually recording the episode from where I used to Pierre recorded the episode from the very room where I think I must have recorded the first 10 or 15 Uncommon Decency episodes. So it was quite fun to see him in that position. And very, very grateful to both of them for coming on. Again, if you want to listen to the Patreon section where we talk a lot more about the difference between the conversations you have in America and especially in Europe and in France, how different societies have responded to the challenges of woke ideas, I think is an interesting topic. So please do join us. It's a great way to support the podcast as well. Thanks a lot, Julian, and see you all soon.
Take care.